The International Journal of Inclusive Democracy, Volume 4, Number 4, October 2008. The Myths About the Economic Crisis, the Reformist Left and Economic Democracy. Takis Fotopoulos. If we want things to stay as they are, things will have to change. Giuseppe Tomasi di Lampedusa, The Leopard, 1958. Although the global financial crisis, which exploded in September, seems to be subsiding at the moment, following the massive state transfers of money from the taxpayers' pockets to those of bankers, financiers and others presumably as a reward for causing the crisis in the first place and for pocketing in the process many billions of dollars in terms of pay, bonuses, etc. The underlying economic crisis itself is far from over. In fact, the financial crisis quickly developed into a full-blown global recession, with stock exchanges and several currency markets in free fall at the time of writing. Yet, despite the fact that the moral bankruptcy of neoliberalism, although not of capitalist market economy itself, which is the ultimate cause of the economic crisis, only today is generally acknowledged almost 20 years since we first attempted to show the catastrophic consequences of it. One should not confuse the moral bankruptcy of neoliberalism with reality, as the supporters of the reformist left do today, who keep repeating the myth of the end of neoliberal globalization and the supposed return of statism. Instead, as I will try to show in this paper, all that we could expect at the end of this particular phase of the chronic capitalist economic crisis, the duration and intensity of which are completely unpredictable, is the replacement of neoliberal globalization by a kind of social liberal globalization which will represent the consensus of both neoliberals and social liberals, the ex-social democrats, and in which the essence of globalization as it is today will remain intact, with the addition perhaps of some controls on financial markets, so that the system could function with fewer and smaller turbulences than the present one, which put the entire system under serious risk of collapse. Therefore, the present talk of the transnational elite Sarkozy, Brown, Bush, et al. About a new system, a brand new capitalism, etc. are simply attempts to disorient people, who are awakening to the new abysmal failure of the capitalist market economy, from the need to replace this system, to an irrelevant discussion about cosmetic changes to it presented as huge systemic changes. 1. The myths about the market system and the financial markets. The market system, the worst way of allocating scarce resources. The present crisis, as well as the previous crises in the period of neoliberal globalization 1987, 1990, 1994, 1997/8, 2001, and those before it during the statist period 1973 April, 1979, etc., as well as those in the pre-war period 1929, 1873 and before, in no way represents something new in the capitalist system of the market economy. It was exactly for this reason that the elimination of the anarchy of the market has always been a basic demand of the anti-systemic left, before the present genetically modified reformist left, which sees nothing wrong with the market system as long as it is socially controlled, became hegemonic. In other words, it is simply not true that capitalism today has turned against its own logic when, by opening and deregulating markets, it has turned the global economy into a planetary casino, as Castoriadis argued. 2. Capitalism has always been, to various degrees, a casino high risk for high profits, and during its entire 200 years history was plague-stricken by crises. The only difference with the past is that this casino is now, as a result of globalization, a planetary one. Furthermore, the only period in the history of capitalism when this was not the case was the half a century or so of socialist statism, social democracy in the West, when these crises were to a certain extent controlled by the state. But, such a period is impossible to be repeated in an internationalist market economy like the present one, as it presupposes a global state, or at least strict global regulations of all markets, which not only are utopian to be implemented given the fundamental unevenness that the market economy itself creates between various areas, but are also incompatible with the very logic and dynamic of an internationalist market economy that has to be based on markets which are as free as possible for profits to be maximized. Therefore, the present crisis of the internationalist market economy has shown once more why the market system is the worst system of allocating scarce resources, as I tried to show elsewhere. 3. The market system is promoted by the system's ideologues as an automatic mechanism within which Adam Smith's invisible hand allocates resources in a supposedly rational way, yesterday within the confines of a nation-state and today within an internationalist market economy. The assumptions on which this mythology of economic liberalism is based are two. First, that the free combination of individual rational decisions leads to a socially rational allocation and, second, that the market mechanism is the most economical information system, which provides the correct incentives that can secure an efficient decentralization of resources. The implication of these assumptions is that the market mechanism is the best system to guarantee a rational allocation of resources, without compromising the autonomy of each individual. A variation of the same myth is used to explain financial markets, which have caused the present crisis, as we shall see below. However, these assumptions are valid only under certain very strict conditions. As a result, the properties of the market that supposedly result in a rational allocation are usually lost once the mythical state of equilibrium is disturbed. Thus, even one of the pioneers of general equilibrium theory, the Nobel Prize winner Kenneth Arrow, has admitted defeat in his efforts to develop a theory showing the capability of a market economy to reach general equilibrium and, after discussing various insoluble technical problems of the theory, he emphasizes that the best known falsification is the recurrent existence of mass unemployment, which is a straightforward contradiction of equilibrium. 4 inches other words, as Will Hutton notes, the major tenet of free market economics that unregulated markets will of their own accord find unimprovable results for all participants is now proved to be nonsense. 5. And of course, reformist economists, like Keynes, and social democrats like Polanyi 6 have shown, long ago, that the market is a crisis-laden system, which cannot secure full utilization of resources and especially of labor. Finally, the inherent tendency of the market economy to lead to concentration of economic power and inequality 7 shows that the present kind of distorted development is the byproduct of a crisis-laden system where only money-backed wants are covered, which do not necessarily coincide with basic human needs. Therefore, orthodox economists, who take for granted the market economy and its supposed superiority, in fact, rationalize the inequality, poverty and misery of some 2 billion of people all over the world for the benefit of the privileged minorities to which they themselves belong. In fact, the freedom of choice that the market economy system supposedly secures means rationing by the wallet. Citizens in a market economy system are not free to choose either as consumers or as producers as consumers, because their choice is constrained by their income wealth. As producers, because the decisions about what and how to produce are taken for them by the market. Furthermore, producers are crucially constrained by their purchasing power, as their access to productive resources and, therefore, their productivity depends on their financial ability. However, economic development became a function of the financial ability of producers very recently, that is, when productive resources became available exclusively through the market. As market relations penetrated all sectors of human activity and local self-reliance was destroyed all over the world, any access to productive resources became a matter of purchasing power. In a market economy system, therefore, the basic economic decisions that a society has to take, that is, what to produce, how and for whom to produce it, are crucially conditioned by the purchasing power of those income groups that can back their demands with money. A continuous bidding is going on for goods, services, resources, and those with the biggest purchasing power are the winners. Thus, the market economy system, contrary to liberal mythology, is the worst system for allocating resources when purchasing power is unequally distributed. Under conditions of inequality, which is of course an inevitable outcome of the dynamic of the market economy, the fundamental contradiction regarding the market satisfaction of human needs becomes obvious, namely, the contradiction between the potential satisfaction of the basic needs of the whole population versus the actual satisfaction of the money-backed wants of part of the population. No wonder that orthodox economists make the convenient assumption of a given distribution of income, when they try to show that the best allocation of resources is the one achieved through the market economy system. The famous analysis of Pareto on optimality, which shows the potential of the market mechanism to secure an optimal allocation of resources, is based on acceptance of the prevailing income distribution. But, particularly in today's neoliberal globalization, inequality is growing rapidly not just between the geographical North and the South, as in the past, but between the New North, those privileged social groups who benefit from globalization, either located in the geographical North or in the South, for example China, India, etc., and the New South, those, either in the North or the South, who pay the price of globalization, as the food crisis and now the financial crisis and the recession show. The most extreme point for income inequality in the U.S. in the 20th century was 1928, just before the Great Depression, when the richest 5% of the population took in more than a third of all personal income. However, in the past 2 or 3 years, the top 5% have concentrated even more income than then, taking in at the moment about 38% of all personal income, according to probably conservative estimates by Emmanuel Cies, economist at the University of California 8. Also, at the global level, the per capita income in the North USA, Canada, Japan, Australia, Switzerland, Norway was in 2003 about 22 times higher than in the South. 9. Given, therefore, the bidding mechanism of the market described above, the system increasingly caters to the needs of the New North, a fact which implies that its rhetoric about freedom of choice in a market system is just empty. Within the framework of the market economy, only a small portion of the Earth's population can satisfy whatever real or imaginary needs they have, drawing on scarce resources and damaging ecosystems, whereas the vast majority of people on the planet cannot even cover their basic needs. However, freedom of choice is meaningless, unless basic needs have already been met. Furthermore, the extreme concentration of economic power, as expressed by the huge inequality in the distribution of income and wealth, has played a crucial role both in the present financial crisis, as we shall see below, and in the acute deterioration of the ecological crisis. This is because inequality is a basic cause for the enthusiastic adoption of the eco-destructive growth objective by the elites all over the world, since the aim of trickle-down economics is, exactly, to maintain the social cohesion of a very unequal society through expanding, rather than redividing, the pie. 10. Financial markets as an indispensable part of the market system. If we define a market economy as an economy which relies primarily on interactions between buyers and sellers to allocate resources, then we can identify the following main types of markets belonging to a market economy, which are integrated into the present internationalist market economy. A. The markets for real resources, that is, productive resources, labor markets, markets for agricultural and urban land, and markets for machines, tools, raw materials, etc., and markets for consumer goods and services. And B. The markets for financial products, such as capital markets used for the raising of capital through shares and bonds, derivatives markets used for the management of financial risk, currency markets used for the transfer of risk with respect to currency variations, etc. To my mind, the distinguishing characteristic between the markets for real resources and those for financial products is that whereas the main determining factor of prices in the former wage rates, rent and land values, prices for machines, tools, etc. is the bargaining power of the social groups which control these resources, workers, capitalists, farmers, landowners, et al., that is, in the last instance, what we can call the class struggle, where class is defined in a broader sense than the usual Marxist one. 11. In the latter, the main determining factor of prices is financial speculation aiming at profit from price fluctuations in the buying, holding, selling, and short selling of stocks, bonds, commodities, currencies, and various derivatives. As regards the derivatives markets in particular, which have played a crucial role in the explosion of the present crisis, the expansion of trade in them during the 1980s and 1990s was a major growth sector in financial markets in general. In fact, it is the uncontrolled expansion of a form of derivatives, the securitized subprime mortgages, which played a significant role in the present crisis. Derivatives are financial products created by the various financial intermediaries in order to exploit the risk arising from variations in the prices of financial products. Anything that carries a price can generate a derivatives market, that is, derivatives are financial contracts sold to pass on risk to others. They are, in other words, private contracts between companies or institutions, which cannot be controlled or properly assessed. No wonder it has been dubbed the world's biggest black hole, because they operate outside of the grasp of governments, tax inspectors and regulators, that is, in a parallel world to the rest of the banking system. The credit or bond derivatives market, the speculative turnover of which alone exceeds $56 trillion, is an example of a derivatives market. The credit derivative swap is effectively an insurance policy against the default in the interest payment on a corporate bond and, in fact, one does not need even to own the bond itself. It is the huge and uncontrollable size of this market that makes it so dangerous. It is estimated that the derivatives market is worth more than $516 trillion, 12, roughly 10 times the value of the entire world's output. Although, therefore, in themselves, derivative contracts are not dangerous, the anarchy of the market makes them potentially lethal. Even if one of these contracts goes wrong, the bad 2%, as it has been called, then the domino effect could have enormous, if not catastrophic, consequences. This is because as derivatives are just paper money, there is nothing backing them, no reserve requirements of any sort, which could back their transactions on them. It is not therefore surprising that Warren Buffett, the American investment guru, dubbed them financial weapons of mass destruction weapons, which in the hands of banks, hedge funds and other speculators in Wall Street, London City and elsewhere, enabled them to make billions of dollars. The above distinction between markets for real resources and markets for financial products, though it looks similar to the Marxist distinction between finance capitalism and industrial capitalism, it is in fact quite different. First, because as I showed elsewhere, 13, the concept of market economy we use is a broader term than capitalism, since the former refers to the way resources are allocated, whereas the latter refers to property relations. Second, because finance capitalism for Marxists is considered as an outgrowth of industrial capitalism and as part of a process signaling the fact that the capitalist period of history has entered its final phase, an outdated view that we do not share. Thus, as a Marxist journal recently put it, financialization has resulted in a new hybrid phase of the monopoly stage of capitalism that might be termed monopoly finance capital. It seemed that finance had developed a new magical circuit, in which money could be made solely out of money, without the intervention of actual production. The new secret of accumulation was presumed to be leverage and risk management, which allowed the purchase of assets that promised higher returns even if they carried a higher risk, and the borrowing of many times the amount the investor had in equity capital, perhaps 10, 20, 30, or in some cases 100 times as much. Finance capital has expanded in parasitic form. 14. In fact, however, banks and other financial intermediaries play an important role and not just a parasitic one in today's globalist capitalism, since they are the main means to bring together lenders from all over the world, from a worker saving in a pension fund for his or her old age up to a sovereign wealth fund, that is, a state-owned investment fund, to borrowers all over the world, from a clerk getting a consumer loan to buy a new car to a government or municipality. It is not, therefore, surprising that the corporate profits of the U.S. finance sector, as the same journal also pointed out, have increased from less than 2% of total domestic corporate profits in the mid-1960s to 40% in the mid of this decade. 15. Yet, although the explosion of financial markets in neoliberal globalization by no means signals, by itself, the approaching death of the capitalist system, this does not mean that the arguments promoted by the system's ideologues about the necessity of financial markets have any validity whatsoever for anybody who does not take the capitalist market economy for granted. It is argued, for instance, that capital markets are important in raising capital, but There could be alternative ways for doing so in a non-market economy or in the transfer of risk, but why there should be any risk in the first instance? Or in helping borrowers to find lenders, but this takes for granted that lending has to be done by private firms rather than, for instance, by demotic enterprises which are controlled by the demos and the decisions of which all citizens, borrowers and lenders alike take part. As I have shown elsewhere, 16. A moneyless, marketless economic democracy is perfectly realistic in the context of a stateless inclusive democracy. 2. The myths about the causes of the current financial crisis. Having discussed the role of markets in general and financial markets in particular, we can demystify the current mythology about the causes of the crisis. Broadly, we may classify as follows the main approaches to the crisis. First, the neoliberal approaches, which take for granted the free and unregulated markets, the main element of neoliberalism, and are supported by the mass media and the system's ideologues. Second, the reformist approaches, whose common characteristic is that they mainly question neoliberalism and either take for granted the capitalist system of market economy and what passes as democracy today, social liberals, that is, ex-social democrats, Keynesians of several varieties, et al., or may criticize the capitalist system and yet adopt reformist strategies and demands, which do not question the very existence of the capitalist market economy and democracy. Reformist left, some varieties of the Marxist left, et al. Finally, the anti-systemic approaches which explicitly question the present system's institutions and values, like the ID approach, the neoliberal approaches. As one could expect, neoliberal ideologues or commissars of the system blamed everybody else apart from the system of free markets for the present crisis. The main trend within this camp attempted through the mass media controlled by the transnational elite to personalize the crisis and its causes, arguing that the crisis is just due to some unscrupulous and greedy bankers and financiers who either did not properly implement the existing rules or, alternatively, created various financial products to effectively bypass these rules, for the sake of maximizing the huge profits made by their institutions and, more importantly, the mythical bonuses and salaries they earned themselves all these years. They're defined, of course, by those controlling the system, and in the latter it is again a system which sends people to the other end of the world to kill other people, as long as they are doing it legally, again the legality being defined by those who sent them in the first instance, that is, those controlling the system again. It is obvious, however, that this simplistic kind of explanation, in fact, creates more questions than it attempts to answer. For one, why during the statist period of the Social Democratic Consensus 1945-1975, when markets, including financial markets, were effectively controlled, similar crises did not arise? Clearly, free and unregulated markets have definitely something to do with the causes of the present crisis. Harvard professor Jeffrey A. Miron expressed a supposedly more sophisticated neoliberal approach. For him, it is the state, yet again, who is to be blamed for the crisis, paraphrasing the famous John Cleese Fawlty Towers sketch, "Don't mention the markets." According to his account, 17. The current mess would never have occurred in the absence of ill-conceived federal policies. The federal government chartered Fannie Mae in 1938 and Freddie Mac in 1970. These two mortgage lending institutions are at the center of the crisis. The government implicitly promised these institutions that it would make good on their debts, so Fannie and Freddie took on huge amounts of excessive risk. Worse, beginning in 1977 and even more in the 1990s and the early part of this century, Congress pushed mortgage lenders and Fannie Freddie to expand subprime lending. The industry was happy to oblige, given the implicit promise of federal backing, and subprime lending soared. However, even if one accepts his claim that Congress, through policies like the Community Reinvestment Act, pressured banks into subprime lending, has indeed pushed F&F and the like to expand this kind of risky lending, still, no global crisis of the present dimensions would have ever been created by subprime lending itself, if the institutional framework allowing F&F and other financiers to securitize their lending was not in place. And it was exactly the system of free and deregulated markets that was established by the neoliberal consensus in the last quarter of a century or so, which has made possible the development of such imaginative financial products as well as their global spreading, a crucial fact for the globalization of the present financial crisis, which presumably did not attract the attention of this erudite economist from Harvard. The social liberal approaches. As I mentioned above, there is a variety of approaches belonging to this category, ranging from social liberals, neo-Keynesians, post-Keynesians and the like, that is, those belonging to the center-left political current of ex-social democrats supporting today the New Labour Party in UK, the renovated Social Democratic Party in Germany, and so on to reformists in the left Greens, some Marxists, et al., who are basically expressing the political platform of the World Social Forum. John Gray, for instance, is a characteristic example of the euphoria created within the center-left because of the financial crisis, which, however, as he stresses, far from being the end of capitalism, the frantic scrambling that is going on in Washington marks the passing of only one type of capitalism, the peculiar and highly unstable variety that has existed in America over the last 20 years. This experiment in financial laissez-faire has imploded. 18 So, for him, as well as for everybody else in the center-left, this is not a systemic crisis but just a crisis of Anglo-Saxon neoliberalism, which clearly is assumed to be a kind of ideology or reversible policy and not a systemic trend, as it is argued by the ID Project. However, although the crisis is not systemic according to Gray, he thinks that it is not also just a normal financial crisis but a historic geopolitical shift. Here is a historic geopolitical shift, in which the balance of power in the world is being altered irrevocably. The era of American global leadership, reaching back to the Second World War, is over. With the nationalization of crucial parts of the financial system, the American free market creed has self-destructed, while countries that retained overall control of markets have been vindicated. It is America's political class that, by embracing the dangerously simplistic ideology of deregulation, has responsibility for the present mess. In these circumstances, will the governments of countries that buy large quantities of American bonds, China, the Gulf states and Russia, for example, be ready to continue supporting the dollar's role as the world's reserve currency? Or will these countries see this as an opportunity to tilt the balance of economic power further in their favor? The U.S. will continue to be the world's largest economy for a while longer, but it will be the new rising powers that, once the crisis is over, buy up what remains intact in the wreckage of America's financial system. Yet, the above untenable conclusions are based on equally false presuppositions. The crisis, contrary to the mythology promoted by the mass media, did not lead to any real nationalizations of crucial parts of the financial system on ideological grounds, as were the post-war nationalizations. Instead, as the political elites in the USA and UK made abundantly clear at the time, any nationalization of banks and other institutions will be temporary and should not be confused with the nationalizations of the past aiming to extend social control at the expense of free markets. Thus, as Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, declared on October 14, the present nationalizations are supposed to last until the financial system has been repaired and reformed. George Bush completed the real picture of what was actually going on by declaring the same day, "This is not intended to take over the free market, but to preserve it." Furthermore, the nationalizations usually meant, particularly in the U.S., the state acquisition of preference shares, which do not carry votes or a say in the affairs of the bank. Finally, the rhetorical question asked by Gray whether the sovereign funds, particularly the Chinese and Indian ones, will continue supporting the dollar's role as the world's reserve currency also implies an unsound possibility that countries like China and India, whose rapid growth crucially depends on their exports to the USA, might be tempted in the future to move their capital elsewhere, presumably ignorant of the fact that such action will cause a major recession in the USA followed by a similar crisis in their own economies. In fact, markets themselves, during the crisis, delivered their own answer to the question whether the Chinese giant can potentially play the role of an alternative pole to the USA. This is how the independent economics editor described the sudden relapse of stock exchanges, following the euphoria at the beginning of the week starting October 13th, when the elites believed that the trillions of taxpayers' dollars pumped into the financial markets seemed at last to work. Last year, the U.S. managed to run up a deficit of $256 billion with China, her biggest trading partner. If Americans stop buying Chinese DVD players, dog food, toys and toothpaste, then China will begin to stumble. Markets across Asia reacted badly, and the fear of global recession spread across every time zone. The mining stocks, bloated on the back of the appetite for coal, copper, zinc and the other raw materials of the Chinese Industrial Revolution, collapsed. The price of oil slumped to below $70 a barrel, half the $147 highs of July 19. This was, of course, in response to the news that the giant mining company Rio Tinto was revising its capital spending plans, leading to a plummeting of its shares, warning at the same time of a major slowdown in China, while the Aluminum Corporation of China Chalco decided to reduce its Chinese output. Then came the news that Chinese economic indicators, from steel prices to housing sales, suggest a severe economic slowdown could be in prospect, and that Chinese factories are reporting that export orders are down sharply. Last week, the government said that half the country's toy makers had gone out of business. The stock market is sharply down, so too are house prices, while car sales have slowed dramatically. Consumers are cutting down on spending as they believe there are tougher times ahead. 20. No wonder that several Western analysts today express the view that the rulers of the world's most populous nation have presided over a bubble economy that is just waiting to pop. 21. All this confirms the conclusions I have drawn elsewhere. 22. That the main poll today is not the U.S. elites, as John Gray and the reformist left in general assume, but the transnational elite. And the only country today which potentially could play the role of an alternative poll to this elite is, for the reasons explained there, Russia and its elite, if it reduces further its economic dependence on its natural resources and if it takes some crucial steps to disintegrate Russia from the internationalist market economy. And these are, of course, very big ifs. Similarly, social liberal economists and Nobelists Paul Krugman and Joseph E. Stiglitz see the causes of the crisis in abuses of the market system and democracy rather than in the system itself. Thus, Krugman talks about the economy of greed as if it is not the system itself that creates greedy people. While Joseph E. Stiglitz rushed to celebrate the House of Representatives' decision to reject the bailout plan, which transferred the cost of the crisis created by the banking system and finance companies onto the taxpayers, a sad day for Wall Street, but it may be a glorious day for democracy. 23. Clearly, Stiglitz must have felt sorry a few days later, when the same representatives passed the same bailout plan, not of course because they were finally persuaded in favor of its merits due to the addition of some cosmetic changes for the benefit of small businesses and middle-income groups, but because they were made to understand by their sponsors that they must dance to their tune if they wished to secure the financing of their expensive electoral campaigns. The reformist left approaches. On the reformist left side, the crisis is blamed not on bad bankers and speculators but on correspondingly bad U.S. neoconservatives and the Anglo-Saxon neoliberals, who adopted the neoliberal analysis of conservative economists Hayek, Friedman, et al. For the reformist left intellectuals, neoliberalism is simply an ideology that, thanks to Thatcher and Reagan, was institutionalized through the liberalization of all markets in the 1980s, including the financial markets, a process which has led to a casino capitalism. According to the same view, the ideology of neoliberal globalization is today collapsing everywhere, and statism returns as supposedly shown by the nationalizations of banks, the famous so-called Brown Plan being implemented at the moment by all major central banks, and the bailout plans, which anyway are not new and happened before, even during the era of neoliberal globalization, both in the 1980s and the 1990s. Thus, Emmanuel Wallerstein 24 talks about the ideology of neoliberal globalization and describes how in the 1980s, these ideas were proposed as a counterview to the equally old Keynesian and/or socialist views. So, for Wallerstein, the Keynesian hegemony in the statist period of modernity and the present neoliberal hegemony simply reflect changes in ideologies reflecting corresponding swings in the political balance. This could explain the following concluding statement, which shows a complete misjudgment of the nature of globalization. Neoliberal globalization will be written about 10 years from now as a cyclical swing in the history of the capitalist world economy. No wonder that in a recent interview he even foresaw the end of capitalism itself. 25. However, as I attempted to show elsewhere, 26, the new form of market economy that has been established in the last quarter of a century or so, which we call an internationalist market economy rather than a globalist economy, which is a misnomer, represents a structural change, a move to a new form of modernity, that is, a move from statist to neoliberal modernity, rather than a change in economic policy and in ideology, as the reformist left argues. In this sense, today's globalization or, preferably, internationalization is indeed a new phenomenon, although it is the outcome of the dynamics of the market economy that was established two centuries ago in interaction with the social struggle. In other words, it was the emergence and rapid expansion of multinational corporations, a new phenomenon in the history of the capitalist market economy, which has led to an initially informal opening and liberalization of markets that was later institutionalized by Thatcherism and Reaganomics. It was this development which, together with the change in the subjective conditions, that is, the decay of the labor and socialist movements in the aftermath of deindustrialization in the West Sea below, have signaled the collapse of social democracy. So, although it is true that the opening and liberalizing of markets was part of a historical trend which had been set in motion by the elites controlling the market economy since its establishment for further marketization, that is to minimize social controls over markets and particularly those aiming to protect labor and the environment that interfered with economic efficiency and profitability, this does not imply, as Wallerstein assumes, that the move from the liberal phase of modernity in the 19th century to the statist one in the 20th and finally to the present neoliberal one was just a matter of changes in policies that are reversible from within the system. In fact, as I tried to show in Towards an Inclusive Democracy, 27, it is only the changes which are consistent with the long-term trend in the system of market economy for further marketization that are reversible within the system. Such were the changes associated with the shift from the statist to the present neoliberal phase. On the other hand, the changes associated with the shift from the liberal to the statist phase were clearly inconsistent with this long-term trend and were in fact imposed through popular pressure on the elites, which were facing the dilemma of either accepting serious social controls on the markets and their freedoms, so that they could save the capitalist system itself and their own skin. Or, alternatively, seeing their own demise, as in the growing at that time camp of actually existing socialism. 28. However, today, not only capitalism is stronger than ever even in the middle of the present catastrophic crisis given the demise of the anti-systemic left and the accommodating role of the reformist left supported by Wallerstein, Chomsky, Albert and others in the form of the World Social Forum, but it has also created the objective conditions which make any reversal of neoliberal globalization from within almost impossible. This is because no reformist left party, even an international one like the European left, could ever implement any effective policies to reverse neoliberalism in a framework of open and liberalized markets. But open and liberalized markets are a sine qua non for the very functioning of an internationalist market economy based on multinational corporations. This is why I referred above to a serious structural change within the capitalist system that neoliberal globalization represents, a change that will obviously be not reversible from within as Wallerstein assumes, since it is only if a left party was prepared to abolish multinational corporations themselves and put markets under strict social controls that such a reversal could take place, and, by then, such a party would have already moved to the anti-systemic left. Furthermore, one could only characterize as ideologically bankrupt that part of the reformist left which perceived the biggest systemic fraud taking place at the moment in the form of the bailout plans and nationalizations of banks as a kind of a return to statism and Keynesianism. In reality, not only do these measures have no relation whatsoever to the social democratic, let alone the socialist ideology, of bringing productive resources under social control, but, in fact, aim at exactly the opposite: the salvation of private banking systems, through the mass redistribution of income and wealth from lower to middle and upper income groups and the economic and political elites who, directly or indirectly, pocketed trillions of dollars in the last few years out of the financial bubbles they themselves created. No wonder that the political elites today, neoliberal and social liberal alike, not only do not question the privatization of the hundreds of state enterprises including basic utilities which have taken place in the last quarter of a century, the instituting of flexible labor markets, the abolition of any strict controls to the movement of commodities and capital, as well as of the progressive system of income taxation which taxed people according to their income level, but they do not even discuss the possibility of fully nationalizing the banking systems, as the only rational medium-term way out of the crisis. Instead, they either socialist through the bailout plans the huge losses of the financial sharks, although they never thought, of course, of socializing as well their gigantic profits, or, alternatively, through the fraudulent Brown plan they inject billions of dollars to the vaults of failing banks, without even securing an effective control of them, as they usually offer the money in exchange for preferred shares with no voting rights. No wonder popular anger is growing, despite the brain cleansing from the international mass media about the necessity of such measures to save jobs. A neo-Marxist approach. According to William Tabb, 29, the contemporary world capitalist system faces not just a financial crisis but four crises, the other three being the crisis of U.S. imperialism, the crisis created by the emergence of a multipolar world, and the crisis resulting from the unbearable pressure on natural resources that the growth economy creates. The financial crisis is seen by this approach in terms of the usual Marxist analysis of overaccumulation. As the author puts it, there is an overinvestment in capacity to produce that cannot be utilized within an irrational social structure in which the only effective demand is that backed by adequate purchasing power. Overproduction in the midst of unmet social needs characterizes the system, as does pressure on workers everywhere to take lower compensation as a result of the class power of capital and its ability to pit workers against each other. The surplus produced and appropriated by capital cannot find outlets in production and spills over into financial speculation, where it is absorbed in speculative bubbles that eventually collapse, spreading chaos and pain through the economy. However, this approach has hardly any relationship to the present reality of an internationalist market economy. For a start, although it is true that the unequal distribution of income and wealth and, therefore, of economic power is at the root of the economic crisis characterizing a market economy, as we shall see in the next section, the cause of this crisis is not that inequality creates a crisis of underconsumption or overproduction, the traditional left argument. As the consumerist boom in the West has shown in the last half of a century, underconsumption is not the problem of capitalist societies at the center for various reasons transcending the scope of the present article, and in fact it is not even the problem in the capitalist periphery, with the creation of a new North in the South, as part of the globalization process we have seen in the first section. Second, it is not true that the surplus produced and appropriated by capital cannot find outlets in production and spills over into financial speculation where it is absorbed in speculative bubbles. Although this may be true in the case of a nation-based market economy, it has very little to do with an internationalist market economy. In fact, most of the surplus which is used today for financial speculation comes from the sovereign funds of such capitalist miracles like China and India, as well as Russian, Arab and Latin American billionaires, that is, from countries in which the extreme inequality in the distribution of income and wealth, in combination with the overexploitation of their labor forces or their natural resources and the effective absence of welfare states, has created lots of surpluses, which their elites, instead of investing them domestically for an improvement in the social wage of their impoverished workers, prefer to invest in Western financial markets, particularly U.S. ones, and speculative bubbles. As regards the second crisis, Tab bases his argument on the assumption that there is a dawning understanding that the United States not only lost Iraq but that the situation in Afghanistan is further revealing an inability to occupy and enforce regime change and imperialist stability. However, one can counter-argue here that the transnational elite and not just the U.S. elite, as this approach assumes far from losing Iraq and Afghanistan, in fact has established there the foundations for regimes controlled by it to govern these countries for any foreseeable future. In other words, even if the transnational elite will have to end the military occupation of these countries and withdraw their ground forces sometime in the near future, this does not mean that it will not have the power to control these countries economically. Look at Vietnam. As well as politically and militarily, as long as another world pole claiming a share of this control does not emerge. The world is full of similar informal protectorate-ish, and surely the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, and even more so the secular nationalist Ba'athist regime in Iraq, 30 did not used to be Western protectorates before the invasion, as they will almost certainly be, even after the withdrawal of the occupying forces from these countries. So, who has lost these countries? Finally, in view of what was said above, the following conclusion drawn by the author is obviously untenable. One impact of this unmasking of the interests that benefited from the Washington Consensus policies was a rush by Western leaders to invite the now more significant developing countries to take a greater role, to be given greater voting rights, and to exercise more power in the Bretton Woods institutions. In fact, this rush, which has indeed materialized in the last few days with respect to the November summit of the G20 to redraw the international economic institutions, has very little to do with the exotic reasons given by the author. Although, it is true that the transnational elite, roughly expressed politically by the G7, is indeed interested in bringing in its formal members, countries like China, India, Brazil, etc. The reason for this is not because they recognize in them the emerging new economic powers of the future, which should share in the running of the new world order. The reason, as we shall see in the last section, is that they wish to involve them in sharing the cost of the economic and the ecological crisis. The moment, however, any of these emerging big powers attempt to follow a really different policy than the one adopted by the G7, they are simply going to be shown the door, as it just happened with Russia this summer. 31. An even greater myth promoted by the reformist left is the end of the U.S. empire that the present crisis supposedly certifies. In fact, in the era of globalization, we cannot talk anymore about an empire based on a single geographical center of power. Economic, as well as political, power today is concentrated at the hands of the transnational elite, which is defined as the elite that draws its power economic, political, or generally social by operating at the transnational level, a fact which implies that it does not express, solely or even primarily, the interests of a particular nation-state. So, although the U.S. elite has played a hegemonic role within the transnational elite because of its superior economic and consequently political power, it ceased playing any hegemonic economic role as soon as other real centers of economic power were created in the post-war period, like Japan and Germany. Therefore, the real issue today is not whether the U.S. empire is falling, something implying the myth that the European elite plays a more progressive role in world affairs, but whether a single country-based empire, rather than a set of countries, could still constitute the basis of a transnational elite in the era of globalization. Concerning the third crisis which, according to William Tabb, contemporary capitalism faces, that is, the crisis created by the emergence of a multipolar world, this false conclusion is based on the usual statistics used by orthodox economists. Thus, the author draws his conclusion by uncritically accepting at face value such projections as that of a 2006 study by PricewaterhouseCoopers LLP that in the year 2050 the Chinese economy would be almost as large as that of the United States in dollar terms, and India would be the third largest. However, such conclusions are based on comparisons of absolute economic indices on income, production, etc., which of course do not make much sense when referring to a country that concentrates 21% of the world's population. That is, if we take into account the enormous differences in population sizes, then, The per capita income of China in terms of purchasing power is only 17% of the corresponding per capita income of the advanced economies in the North. 32% however, even the much advertised, by neoliberals and social liberals, record growth of China, following the full integration of the country into the internationalized market economy, disguises an almost negligible increase in per capita income. Thus, in 1994, after 14 years of GDP growth at a record rate of 10%, China's per capita income was about 10% of that of the US. 33. After 10 more years of a record growth, in 2003, China's per capita income had just reached 13% of that of the USA. 34. This means that, even if China could continue indefinitely the growth rates of that period, something almost impossible for economic and ecological reasons again, it would take the Chinese not a few more decades, but some centuries even to approach the per capita income of the US and that of the advanced capitalist countries in the EU. Similar considerations apply to the other miracle of capitalist development, India, which, even more than China, consists of a few islands of development within a vast sea of poverty and underdevelopment. At this point, neoliberals and social liberals usually refer to the alleged dramatic reduction of poverty in China, which, however, is almost entirely due to the fact that the Communist Party elite removed from the list of poor Chinese 422 million in the 1981 to 2001 period, because they had reached the respectable income of $1 per day, the arbitrary criterion used by international organizations to define absolute poverty. 35. Reducing with a stroke by a third the number of absolutely poor, from 634 million in 1981 to 212 million in 2001. 36. In the meantime, as a result of Chinese growth, the country today, according to official figures, has one of the most unequal income distributions in the world, with 20% of the richest Chinese holding 50% of the country's wealth, while the poorest 20% holding only 4.7%. No wonder China has today one of the highest Gini coefficients. This is the index used to measure inequality in the world, even worse than that of neoliberal Britain and the USA, and almost twice as that of the Nordic countries. 37. Finally, another important indication of the kind of development going on in countries like China and India, which, far from indicating the emergence of new economic giants to challenge the transnational elite in the future, in fact, shows the growing economic dependence of these countries on this elite, as the significance of foreign capital and foreign trade with respect to this process. Foreign capital, namely the multinationals which were established in China to exploit the abysmally low wages reaching 1/30th of those in the West, 38, turned the country into the assembly line of the transnational elite, with over 60% of Chinese exports and almost all its high-tech exports consisting of products made in China by foreign companies, mostly multinational corporations from the countries of the transnational elite. 39. Here is how Will Hutton summarizes Chinese development. 40. China is certainly emerging as a leading exporter, but essentially it is a subcontractor to the West. It has not bucked the way globalization is heavily skewed in favor of the rich developed nations. Its productivity is poor. It lacks international champions. Its innovation record is lamentable. It relies far too much on exports and investment to propel its economy. Given, therefore, the degree of dependence of Chinese growth on direct investment from and exports to the countries of the transnational elite, particularly USA, any crisis in the transnational elite countries directly affects Chinese growth, as the present crisis has already shown, with Chinese stock exchanges in Shanghai and Hong Kong falling as much as the other stock exchanges in the world, and the developing global recession already hitting hard Chinese growth. Last, but not least, one could reasonably assume that the present record growth rates are not sustainable anyway, because of the tremendous damage they are inflicting onto the environment, as shown by the accelerating desertification of the country and the massively increasing pollution, which already leads to the premature death of 400,000 people a year. 41. This brings us to the fourth crisis mentioned by the author, that is, the one related to the depletion of resources as part of the ecological crisis. However, Although this crisis is indeed a constituent element of the multidimensional crisis the capitalist world faces today, it is not directly relevant to the financial crisis to which we now turn. 3. The inclusive democracy approach on the causes of the crisis. The present multidimensional crisis. Few, outside the system's ideologues, would doubt today that present society, which takes everywhere the form of a neoliberal market growth economy and representative democracy, faces a profound and widespread crisis encompassing all spheres of social life. According to the inclusive democracy ID approach, the following are the main characteristics of this crisis. It is a multidimensional crisis involving the economic, the political, the ecological, the social, as well as the cultural levels. It is a universal crisis in the sense that it envelops all parts of the world that are integrated in the new world order established by the internationalist market economy and its political complement of representative democracy. In fact, it is precisely the universal character of this crisis that differentiates it from other crises in the past. It calls into question practically every structure and idea that supports contemporary heteronomous societies in East and West, North and South. Therefore, the present crisis calls into question not just the political, economic, social and ecological structures that emerge with the rise of the system of market economy, but also the actual values that have sustained these structures and particularly the post-Enlightenment meaning of progress and its partial identification with growth. The causes of this multidimensional crisis can safely be attributed, as I tried to show elsewhere, 42 to the very institutions of modernity, which today have been universalized. In other words, it is the dynamics of the market economy and representative democracy that have led to the present concentration of power at all levels, which, in turn, is the ultimate cause of every dimension of the present crisis. Thus, as regards the economic dimension of the crisis, it can easily be shown that it is the concentration of economic power, as a result of commodity relations and the grow-or-die dynamic of the market economy, which has led to a chronic economic crisis. Therefore, the result of the present universalization of the market growth economy and its present neoliberal form necessitated by the opening of the markets due to the massive expansion of transnational corporations in the last quarter of a century or so is the creation of a bipolar world consisting of one world which includes the privileged social groups benefiting from globalization, either in the North or the South, what we call the New North, and another world which is left out of the supposedly universal benefits of neoliberal globalization and which includes the marginalized majority of the world population. Either in the North or the South, the New South. Neoliberal globalization has led to an unprecedented increase in world inequality, as confirmed also by the latest International Labour Organization report, which concluded that since the early 1990s, that is, the time neoliberal globalization began flourishing all over the planet, income inequality grew dramatically in most regions of the world. As Raymond Torres, director of the institute responsible for the report, stressed, 43. This report shows conclusively that the gap between richer and poorer households widened since the 1990s. This reflects the impact of financial globalization and a weaker ability of domestic policies to enhance the income position of the middle class and low-income groups. The present global financial crisis is bound to make matters worse unless long-term structural reforms are adopted. Thus, as the report shows, between 1990 and 2005, approximately two-thirds of the countries experienced an increase in income inequality, with the income gap between the top and bottom 10% of wage earners increased in 70% of the countries for which data are available. At the same time, the income gap between top executives and the average employee widened even further in 2003. The chief executive officers CEOs of the 15 largest companies in the USA earn 360 times more than the average worker. By 2007 they earn 520 times more. As one could expect, and the report itself showed, this huge and growing concentration of income was accompanied by the worsening of a parallel social crisis shown, for instance, by higher crime rates. In Britain, for instance, it took 30 years for the reportedly crime rate to double, from 1 million incidents in 1950 to 2.2 million in 1979. However, in the 1980s, the crime rate has more than doubled, and it reached the 5 million mark in the 1990s to approach the 6 million mark at present. The ruling elites respond to the explosion of crime by building new jails. Thus, the prison population in England and Wales increased from 64,000 at the beginning of the decade to 77,000 a couple of years ago, while the most recent Home Office projections forecast a jail population of up to 90,000 by 2010. 44. Similarly, it took the United States 200 years to raise its prison population to a million, but only the last 10 years to raise it to almost 2.2 million, with 680 people in jail for every 100,000, a quarter of the world's total prison population. In fact, the explosion of crime also caused by the criminalization of major sectors of the population, for example in the USA. African Americans are about 12% of the population, but represent half the prison population, as Martin Wallcott 45 points out, tends to take the form of an insurgency in urban conglomerations all over the world, and is treated as such by the ruling elites. A similar process of concentration of political power at the hands of political elites has also been going on during the period beginning with the last quarter of the 18th century, when the founding fathers of the U.S. Constitution literally invented representative democracy, an idea without any historical precedent in the ancient world since. Until that time, democracy had the classical Athenian meaning of the sovereignty of demos, in the sense of the direct exercise of power by all citizens. It was the dynamics of representative democracy that had led to a corresponding concentration of political power. Thus, the concentration of political power in the hands of parliamentarians in liberal modernity has led to an even higher degree of concentration in the hands of governments and the leadership of mass parties in statist modernity, at the expense of parliaments. In the present neoliberal modernity, the combined effect of the dynamics of the market economy and representative democracy has led to the conversion of politics into statecraft, 46, with think tanks designing policies and their implementation. Thus, a small clique around the prime minister or the president concentrates all effective political power in its hands, particularly in major market economies that are significant parts of the transnational elite, and even more so in those governed by a two-party political system, US, UK, Germany, Australia, etc. Furthermore, the continuous decline of the state's economic sovereignty is being accompanied by the parallel transformation of the public realm into pure administration. A typical example is the European Central Bank, or the Bank of England, which have taken control of the euro and sterling respectively and take crucial decisions about the economic life of millions of citizens, independently of political control. So, a crisis in politics has developed in the present neoliberal modernity that undermines the foundations of representative democracy and is expressed by several symptoms which, frequently, take the form of an implicit or explicit questioning of fundamental political institutions, parties, electoral contests, etc. Such symptoms are the significant and usually rising abstention rates in electoral contests, particularly in USA and UK, the explosion of discontent in the form of frequently violent riots, the diminishing numbers of party members, the fact that respect for professional politicians has never been at such a low level, etc. Thus, in the context of the present neoliberal consensus, the old ideological differences between the left and the right have disappeared. At the same time, the collapse of socialist statism in the East, instead of functioning as a catalyst for the building of a new non-authoritarian type of politics which would develop further the ideas of May 1968, simply led to a general trend particularly noticeable among students, young academics and others towards a postmodern conformism and the rejection of any universalist and a systemic project. The rest, including most of the underclass, who are the main victims of the neoliberal internationalist economy, have fallen into political apathy and an unconscious rejection of established society, a rejection that usually has taken the form of an explosion of crime and drug abuse, and sometimes violent riots. Still, Seattle, Genoa and Paris yesterday, or Athens today, are clear indications of the fact that today's youth is not apathetic towards politics conceived in the classical meaning of the word as self-management, but only with respect to what passes as politics today, that is, the system which allows a social minority professional politicians to determine the quality of life of every citizen. In other words, what has transformed politics into statecraft and turned many people away from this sort of politics is the growing realization of the concentration of political power in the hands of professional politicians and various experts as a result of the dynamic of representative democracy. The same applies to the radical people's movements in Venezuela, Bolivia, Argentina, and Brazil, who exert significant pressure from below for new direct democratic forms of organization. Furthermore, the present crisis is also a cultural crisis, since the establishment of the market economy implied sweeping aside traditional cultures and values. This process was accelerated in the 20th century with the spreading all over the world of the market economy and its offspring, the growth economy. As a result, today, there is an intensive process of cultural homogenization at work, which not only rules out any directionality towards more complexity, but is in effect making culture simpler, with cities becoming more and more alike, people all over the world listening to the same music, watching the same soap operas and DVDs, buying the same brands of consumer goods, etc. The rise of neoliberal globalization in the last quarter of a century or so has further enhanced this process of cultural homogenization. This is the inevitable outcome of the liberalization and deregulation of markets and the consequent intensification of commercialization of culture. As a result, traditional communities and their cultures are disappearing all over the world, and people are converted to consumers of a mass culture produced in the advanced capitalist countries and particularly the USA. Last, but not least, there is also a related ideological dimension of the cultural crisis. The changes in the structural parameters marking the transition to neoliberal modernity were accompanied by a parallel serious ideological crisis, which put into question not just the political ideologies, what postmodernists call metanarratives, or even objective reason 47 inches general, but reason itself. This is shown by the present flourishing of irrationalism in all its forms, from the revival of old religions like Christianity, Judaism and Islam, etc., up to the expansion of various irrational trends, for example mysticism, spiritualism, astrology, esotericism, neopaganism and New Age, rejection of scientific medicine in favor of various forms of alternative therapies, which use methods that usually have nothing to do with reason and testable hypotheses, etc. The rise of irrationalism in particular is a direct result of the crisis of the growth economy and both its capitalist and socialist versions. As I attempted to show elsewhere, 48, the collapse of the two main projects of modernity, that is, the socialist and the economic development projects, 49 inches combination with the parallel credibility crisis of science that developed in the last quarter of a century or so, were crucial to the present flourishing of irrationalism. The ID view on the causes of the present financial crisis. As it was mentioned above, the financial crisis cannot just be attributed to greedy and unscrupulous bankers and financiers, if not to the state itself, as neoliberals assert, nor simply to the neoliberal deregulation of financial markets, as social liberals assume, calling today for a new Bretton Woods see next section. In fact, deregulating the financial markets is only part of the story and by itself could not explain, for instance, where the unscrupulous financiers found the huge capital resources to engage in their activities. At this point, however, the most sophisticated supporters of the social liberal thesis bring in the Chinese factor. It was, they argue, the huge reserves collected by the Chinese sovereign funds, which financed this huge swindle. But then more questions arise which are left unanswered. How did the Chinese amass this huge capital, and what was the role of the existing system in allowing the Chinese elites to play this game? Clearly, many more factors have to be brought into the picture, apart from the deregulation of financial markets, to answer these questions, like the parallel deregulation of labor markets in China, which allowed multinationals based in the countries of the transnational elite, basically, the G7 countries, to move their operations into the new economy of China, that is, a huge paradise of low-cost production, and convert it into the assembly line of the advanced capitalist countries. Similarly, without the opening and deregulation of commodity markets, the Chinese would not have been able to export the high-tech products of multinational corporations all over the world as made in China and make the huge surpluses of reserves which, instead of being used to cover the basic needs of the Chinese people like health and education, were then exported to American and other Western banks, providing the liquidity needed by financiers to engage in the big swindle. Finally, without the opening and deregulation of capital markets, none of the above activities, that is, neither the move of massive investment capital by multinational corporations from the West to paradise countries like China and India would have been possible nor, later on, the opposite flow of finance capital from these countries to the bank vaults of countries in the North. Therefore, much more is involved in the financial crisis than the deregulation of the financial markets. In fact, what is involved is the opening and deregulation of all markets, that is, the very essence of neoliberal globalization. But how was this major structural change in the market economy brought about? Were just the ideologues of neoliberalism and the Chicago School of Economics that suddenly prevailed over the Keynesian orthodoxy of the statist post-war period who, after persuading the political elites in USA and UK, imposed these ideologies or bad policies? If this is the case, then all we have to do now, as social liberals assert, is simply impose some controls on the financial markets to sort out a crisis which has already developed into a world recession, and possibly a full-blown depression. But, in fact, as I tried to show elsewhere 50, this is not at all the case. The arrangements adopted in the post-war period in order to open and liberalize the markets, predominantly institutionalist rather than created the present form of the internationalist market economy. In other words, it was the market economy's grow-or-die dynamic and, in particular, the emergence and continuous expansion of transnational corporations TNC and the parallel development of the euro-dollar market, which led to its internationalist form today. The euro-dollar market 51 provided in effect a regulation-free environment where US dollars and later other strong currencies like the yen, mark, etc. could be borrowed and lent free of any US regulatory and tax requirements. The growth of this new market, which simply reflected the growing needs of transactional corporations, was instrumental in the later lifting of exchange and capital controls. This is because the exchange controls of nation-states, particularly those in Britain where the euro-dollar market originated, were put under severe strain throughout the 1970s. So, the opening and liberalizing of markets was simply part of a historical trend 52 which has been set in motion by the elites controlling the market economy since its establishment to minimize social controls over markets and particularly those aiming to protect labor and the environment that interfered with economic efficiency and profitability. Thus, as regards first the institutionalization of the opening of markets, commodity markets were in a process of continuous opening throughout the period following the Second World War both at the planetary level yet rounds of tariff reductions so that TNCs could easily move commodities among their subsidiaries and the regional level European Economic Community EEC, European Free Trade Area EFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement NAFTA, Southern Cone Common Market Mercosur, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations ASEAN Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation APEC. Second, once the opening of markets was institutionalized, the uninhibited flow of capital and commodities across frontiers required the parallel liberalization of all markets that is, the minimization of social controls that have been imposed in the past, in the context of the social struggle, in order to protect human labor and society itself from the market. Therefore, although the labor markets were not fully open so that the exploitation of cheap local labor, particularly in the South, could continue, their liberalization was also necessary for the advantages of opening the commodity and capital markets to be fully utilized. Labor had to be made as flexible as possible, so that it could become easily adjustable to the rapid changes in technology and the organization of production. The institutional arrangements to liberalist markets included the formal opening of capital markets, which were in the process of informal opening throughout the 1970s, in Britain and the USA at the end of the decade when capital and exchange controls were abolished, followed by the rest of the world in the 1980s and the 1990s. The setting up of international rules by the WTO which succeeded the GATT that would make trade as free as possible, through the minimization of the ability of national governments to impose effective controls to protect labor and the environment. The worldwide institutionalization of flexible labor markets, so that the cost of production is minimized, making the movement of investment capital as profitable as possible. The privatization of state enterprises, which not only liberated more sectors of economic activity from any effective form of social control, but also gave the opportunity to TNCs to expand their activities in new areas. The drastic shrinking of the welfare state, so that, on the one hand, the expansion of the private sector in social services can be facilitated and, on the other, a drastic reduction of the tax burden on the economic elites is made possible, through the effective abolition of the progressiveness of the income tax system, that is, the grading of tax rates according to the level of income, the drastic cut in corporation tax rates, etc. The arrangements to liberalize the markets constitute the essence of what has been called neoliberalism/neoliberal policies in effect, a misleading term since such policies have been introduced worldwide by governments of all persuasions, not only of the right, Reagan, the Bush family, Thatcher, et al., but also of the left, what I call social liberal in Europe, Australasia, etc. Therefore, it is clear that these policies reflect the structural changes of the market economy and the corresponding business requirements of late modernity. In this sense, they are systemic or endogenous policies necessitated by the dynamics of the market economy. In fact, the neoliberal policies initiated by the economic elites of late modernity to liberalize the newly opened international markets plainly repeated a similar process that was initiated by the economic elites of early modernity, at the beginning of the 19th century, to liberalize the national markets, which had emerged at the end of the 18th century. Still, for the reformist left, neoliberalism as well as globalization are merely utopias that the economic elites attempt to impose, in the context of a project that aims to create the conditions under which the neoliberal theory can be realized. 53. However, the very fact that there is a broad consensus between all major political parties in the major market economies to implement such policies is an obvious indication that the presently universal neoliberal policies, far from being a utopia, in fact, reflect the structural changes of late modernity. Once we adopt the above analytical framework, we can easily explain how the present crisis exploded in September 2008 and has been worsening. Thus, once capital and labor markets were liberalized, in almost every part of the world including communist China, all major multinational corporations based in the countries of the transnational elite began moving significant parts of their manufacturing industries, in some cases even services, as for example in India, to these paradises of low-cost production, the immediate result being the deindustrialization of the North and the corresponding pseudo-industrialization of some countries in the South. This has led to the creation of a new international division of labor, which institutionalized keeping high technology, research and development, as well as specialized products like financial services, in the metropolitan centers which still concentrate the real planetary economic power and, at the same time, transferring large parts of the manufacturing process to countries such as China and India, where various development islands have been created within vast oceans of misery and underdevelopment, which feed the new mainly controlled by the metropolitan center's export industries with abundant and well-disciplined labor. So, the made in China or made in India, etc. exports created huge amounts of foreign currency reserves while their elites, instead of investing them domestically in order to meet the basic needs of their peoples, which after the privatization of social services like health and education were not covered anymore, preferred to transfer the reserves to the banks and financial institutions of the North and particularly the USA. In effect, it was this reverse flow of capital from these countries to capitalist centers, which allowed the transnational elite and its hegemonic part in the U.S. elite to find the money to carry out their criminal wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, while, at the same time, it increased liquidity in the borrowing countries, making money easily available and cheap, that is, driving down interest rates and helping the flourishing of the real estate bubble, particularly in the USA. the consequences of this process, which was described in the previous issue, 54 were not only the creation of massive unemployment in the West, which was later transformed with the crucial help of flexible labor markets that were introduced as part of the neoliberal package from open unemployment to disguised unemployment in the form of part-time work, occasional work, massive training programs and so on, but also the huge expansion of the financial market, which, through the opening and deregulation of markets, has been globalized. In Britain, for instance, the financial and business services sector has been responsible for almost half of the growth in the economy, and the London city and the housing market have been proving recently the two main sources of growth. No wonder some analysts argue that it is an exaggeration, but perhaps not much of one, to say Britain is dependent on speculation. 55. Similarly, in America's profit surge of 2006, financial services pocketed by far the lion's share, 32.8%. 56. The main profit engine was proprietary trading. Thus, traders began by offering sound loans to cover the property needs of the wealthy middle classes, and when, at some point, the possibilities for further expansion in this part of the market were exhausted, they turned to attract the low and marginal income groups, which were keen to take part in the American dream, but also represented a case of high risk and also high profit possibility, that is, they turned to lend in the subprime market. Dreamy-eyed risk groups, African Americans, Latinos and other working poor, bought into exploitative loan schemes with slogans such as bad credit, no problem, quick and easy money, 0% down payment, creative financing with teaser rates. 57. The inevitable result was that when, after an introductory period of low mortgage repayments, these repayments began rising steeply, about 14% of subprime borrowers defaulted. 58. In the first quarter of 2007, repossessions followed. Meanwhile, the dealers, who controlled these financial dealings, had taken care, using various financial devices, to transfer the risk involved to others than themselves. For this, they used a securitization process by packaging up the debts into negotiable bonds, which could then be sold to banks, hedge funds and other investors, from Zurich to Shanghai, whereas at the same time risky loans could be wiped off the balance sheets of the issuing banks. On this they were significantly helped by the parallel liberalization of financial markets, which allowed financial companies to lend them amounts of money which had almost no relation at all to their customer deposits, whereas, in the past banks had to keep a ratio of at least 10% or so of their loans, etc. in the form of reserves created by customer deposits, etc. As a result, bank lending by far outstripped customer deposits, and when confidence collapsed banks were left with billions of dollars of loans they could not dump. In fact, no one knew where the debt was, causing further market blockage. Today many financial institutions all over the world may be already bankrupt or at least unable to fulfill their obligations to depositors. Inevitably, banks and financial companies ceased trusting, and therefore, lending each other. This brought the financial markets at a standstill, and governments, beginning with the U.S. government, began nationalizing not the banks and financial institutions which were heavily involved in this predatory process, but just the toxic assets. As this was proved inadequate, they were forced to implement the Brown Plan of capitalizing banks, etc. that is, pumping more taxpayers' money into them to replace toxic assets with healthy ones, so that they could persuade the financial markets to start lending again and put the banking system, which was at a standstill, back into action. This, of course, had nothing to do with nationalization, partial or not, as they euphemistically called it to confuse people. A nationalization implies not only ownership, but also control, and clearly the second condition was not satisfied when these nationalizations usually meant the state acquisition of preferred shares, which do not give to the state even voting rights. This means that banks are effectively incontrollable on how they use the huge sums of taxpayers' money, and reports have already surfaced that bankers might be using the money to buy other banks, pay dividends, give employees a raise and executives a bonus, or just sit on it. 59. Even more fraudulent is the claim, supported also by some in the reformist left, including some Marxists, that what we see today is the return of some kind of statism. But statism was associated with a series of important characteristics that are completely missing today, that is, the regulation of commodity markets and the subsidization of domestic industries, so that they could withstand the competition from bigger and therefore more competitive foreign industries, etc. Instead, what we see today is the continuation of the privatization process, and national airlines like Alitalia and Olympic Airways are effectively being privatized, and the states are penalized for subsidizing them by order of the part of the European part of the transnational elite within the EU, at the very moment Social Democrats celebrate the return of statism. The regulation of labor markets, instead of their present deregulation which has led to the universalization of the hire and fire culture, the state obligation for full employment, which would not have allowed the present generalization of part-time and occasional work, the protection of labor relations instead of the present effective undermining of trade union legislation, etc. The regulation of capital markets instead of the present opening and freeing of them, which has led to immense capital flows that made easy the huge speculation activity. A steeply progressive income tax system and high corporation tax rates in order to improve the distribution of income and wealth, instead of the present regressive personal income tax system and low corporate taxes, which have led to the present unprecedented inequality in the distribution of income and wealth. A thriving full welfare state, instead of the present safety nets. 4. A new social liberal consensus or economic democracy? Is a social liberal consensus the answer? While the economic crisis is getting worse by the day, the transnational elite and particularly the representative of good EU capitalism, Nicolas Sarkozy, promotes another myth, the myth that, following the failure of free markets expressed by neoliberal globalization, a new capitalism is emerging, a capitalism with a human face where the markets will be controlled by society through the state. This, despite the fact that at the very meeting of the main partners in the transnational elite, namely, the representatives of the US elite and those of the EU elite, in Camp David, on October 19, 2008, to discuss reform of global capitalism and the Bretton Woods second, the US elite, through President Bush, stressed that, as we make the regulatory and institutional changes necessary to avoid a repeat of this crisis, it is essential that we preserve the foundations of democratic capitalism, a commitment to free markets, free enterprise and free trade. Gordon Brown was even clearer on how the transnational elites see the future reforms. 60. I admire the market's ability to release the dynamism and enterprise of people, and so this new Labour government is pro-business and pro-markets and always will be. In the 1940s, visionaries took on the challenges of the day and built international institutions that have lasted for 60 years. But they were designed for an era of sheltered markets and national competition. Now we must build global institutions for an era of global markets and global competition. I have set out my proposals for a new global early warning system, for cross-border supervision, for action to eliminate the conflicts of interest that have dragged our world economy down, and for fundamental reform of international institutions. At the same time, Peter Mandelson, who expresses a hardcore of European social liberalism and just left the European Commission to join Gordon Brown's government, in an article published the very day he joined the British government, clarified the policy of social liberal consensus that will characterize the transnational elite with respect to neoliberal globalization in the future. 61. Whatever our response, we should be guided by two principles. First, we should not jettison our commitment to globalization. Second, a global economy needs global governance. States and effective governance is what makes globalization possible. They preserve open markets, enforce rules and responsibilities, and manage the risks for individuals and society. We have been reminded over the past 2 weeks that the state underpins the market as lender of last resort. But it has a legitimate claim to a wider role. Its role is to ensure that the conduct of individuals or businesses does not put at risk the stability of the system or the foundations of our economies. Of course, informal global governance already exists, even though Mandelson pretends ignorance. In the form of the G7, which faithfully expresses the views of the transnational elite, 62, that is, of the elites which control through the transnational corporations the world economy, as well as the world polity, through their control of the international political, military and cultural organizations. Although differences in tactics did arise on several occasions in the past between its members, Iraq invasion, Kyoto Agreement, etc. When, therefore, Mandelson talks about global governance, he refers in fact to a virtual governance perfectly compatible with the era of virtual reality we live today, in which such countries are supposedly going to run the new world order as South Korea, Argentina and Brazil at the edge of bankruptcy at the moment, India in which the majority of the population starves so that its elite could waste millions of dollars on space expeditions, and the inevitable Chinese giant, where the growth bubble based on made-in-China exports of multinational corporations has already began deflating. At the same time, the text of the invitation for the November 15th summit in USA of the members of the G20 made abundantly clear the transnational elite's intentions. The summit will also provide an important opportunity for leaders to strengthen the underpinnings of capitalism by discussing how they can enhance their commitment to open, competitive economies, as well as trade and investment liberalization. 63. Hence, it is clear that the essence of globalization is here to stay, with some modifications as regards the formal composition of the political elite and the control of financial markets, or, as Mandelson aptly put it in the subtitle of his article, we need another Bretton Woods to lessen the risks but keep the benefits of world financial markets. The formal expansion Gram 7 into Gram 20 is therefore a device to involve the emerging powers in sharing the economic cost of the present crisis, as well as the ecological cost of checking the rapid deterioration of the ecological crisis, given that their consensus is necessary in this process. Informal power, however, will remain concentrated at the hands of G7, as at present, although the hegemonic power that the U.S. elite enjoyed following the 1945 Bretton Woods Conference could also be replaced by a more equal distribution of political power among its members to reflect the decrease in U.S.'s economic power relative to that of the EU members of G7. The German finance minister Peer Steinbrück made clear this intention when he stated just before the Camp David meeting, the U.S. will lose its superpower status in the world financial system. The world financial system is becoming multipolar 64, although by multipolar he simply meant the long overdue institutionalization of the present situation, that is, of a transnational elite running the world economy and consisting of the elites from US, EU and Japan, rather than China, India and Brazil. The IMF and World Bank may also be restructured to have power to control more strictly financial markets through, for instance, as Brown proposed, an early warning system for the world economy to ensure that problems are anticipated earlier. A framework to ensure crises are dealt with better as they arise. Cross-border colleges of supervisors to monitor the world's top 30 companies and financial institutions that trade across borders, curbing the uncontrollable risk-taking activities of bankers and financiers in their pursuit of scandalous bonuses and pay rates, etc. So, the new Bretton Woods, which is planned by the transnational elite, as well as the new capitalism, which is being promoted at the moment, are going to leave intact the essence of present neoliberal globalization, as expressed by the open and liberalized capital and commodity markets and the flexible labor relations imposed by the liberalization of labor markets. This implies the following: the continuation of the present type of state interference on the economy to tackle the growing recession through the supply side of the economy, that is, enhancing the motives to invest and save by means of lower interest rates, proportionately lower income tax rates for the higher income groups, lower corporation taxes, etc., rather than through active state interference on the demand side of the economy, as used to be the Keynesian kind of policy effectively implemented by social democrats in the statist phase of modernity. The continuation and further expansion of the privatizations program into those sectors which are still nationalist, for example national airlines like Alitalia and Olympic Airways. At the same, the few private banks that were nationalists during the present crisis are expected to return to the private sector as soon as they become profitable again. the continuation of the present dissolution of welfare states and their replacement with safety nets for the lower income groups, together with the parallel enhancement of the privatization of health and education services for the middle classes. Everything, therefore, that characterizes the essence of present globalization, which is summed up by the huge inequality in the distribution of income, wealth and economic power, is here to stay, for as long as the market system economy and representative democracy, the pillars of the present system that secure this inequality in the distribution of economic and political power respectively, are reproduced. Economic democracy as the only way out of the crisis. Clearly, the planned reform of the financial system, at best, would reduce the frequency of financial crises, although not necessarily their intensity, as the historical experience shows, and certainly would do nothing at all to tackle the causes of the broader economic crisis I discussed above, let alone the other dimensions of the multidimensional crisis. This is because the reimposition of some financial controls, this time at the global level to increase their effectiveness in a globalized economy, simply aims to stabilize the financial system and generally the system of the market economy and protect it from destabilizing financial crises that could easily develop into major recessions, if not depressions. But such controls do nothing at all by themselves to deal with the root cause of the economic crisis, that is, the huge and growing concentration of income and wealth, and consequently economic power, between the New North and the New South, as defined above. Therefore, inequality, with its economic, political and social implications, the continuing destruction of the environment, unemployment and job insecurity, as well as misery for most of the world's population, will continue, so that the elites and the privileged social groups all over the world could continue enjoying their lavish living patterns at the expense of the rest of the world. In the meantime, people are increasingly realizing, particularly after the latest crisis which may last for a significant time, that their economic fate, in fact, the quality of their lives, is not and could not be controlled by themselves within the market system, but is controlled instead by invisible forces, the market forces, and the visible economic and political elites which control them. Working people are today at a loss to understand why their work is no longer required, for no fault of their own, by those controlling the market forces and, as a result, become unemployed. In Britain alone, unemployment is expected to double as a result of the financial crisis, from 1.5 million at the beginning of the crisis in the summer to 3 million by 2010, if not earlier. People at retirement age could not understand why their projected pensions could be halved, while many of their savings, for which they worked all their lives in order to secure some sort of decent retirement, will be lost, so that financiers and bankers could make billions of dollars in terms of bonuses and extra pay in the last few years. Still others see their dreams of buying a flat or a house for them and their families to be destroyed, with repossessions growing all the time and their savings lost in the cyberspace of financial dealings behind their backs. But why should we take a system like the present catastrophic one for granted? Economic systems are not God's creations. They are man's creations, as God himself is. The central planning system of actually existing socialism, despite the fact that, as far as meeting the basic needs of all people was concerned, it was far superior than the capitalist system, collapsed not just because it was a failure, but because people ceased to take it for granted. So, why do people take for granted the system of the capitalist market economy, despite its catastrophic economic and environmental failure, to mention the two main forms of failure? Clearly, the collapse of actually existing socialism and of the socialist project itself have played an important role in this, but this is not enough to explain the apathy, even in the face of the present economic and ecological crisis. Particularly so, when today we can envisage a very different world in which people could themselves control their own lives and their relations with the social and natural worlds, rather than leaving such crucial decisions to elites, which primarily are interested in meeting their own needs. Economic democracy, as a constituent part of inclusive democracy envisaged by the ID Project, proposes the kind of economic organization that we particularly need today, not only because this is the kind of economic organization that could secure individual and collective autonomy at the economic level, but also because it represents, At least to my mind, the best way of transcending the chronic economic crisis, which began with the establishment of the capitalist system of market economy 2 centuries ago, a crisis which periodically deteriorates, destroying in the process the lives of many more people than it normally does. A model of economic democracy, as an integral part of an inclusive democracy, is described in detail elsewhere 65. I will describe only briefly why, within the context of an economic democracy as defined by the ID project, which is a very different conception from the usual conception of economic democracy given by Greens, social democrats, social ecologists, communalists, paraconists, et al. The crises described above are simply impossible. First, the present huge and growing inequality in income, wealth and economic power is impossible given that in an economic democracy, all macroeconomic decisions, namely, decisions concerning the running of the economy as a whole, overall level of production, consumption and investment, amounts of work and leisure implied, technologies to be used, etc., are made by the citizen body collectively and without representation. However, this does not mean that people are deprived of their freedom of choice that the market system supposedly provides. This is because the individual producers and consumers, through a proposed system of vouchers or credit cards, make all microeconomic decisions at the workplace or the household levels. The equal distribution of economic power that economic democracy implies, in combination with the equal distribution of political and social power that political democracy, direct democracy and democracy at the social level, self-management institutionalists in an inclusive democracy, create the institutional preconditions that would make the present multidimensional crisis a thing of the past. Second, within such a system, there will be no economic or political elites or privileged social groups, given that the main characteristic of the proposed model is that it explicitly presupposes a stateless, moneyless and marketless economy, which precludes private accumulation of wealth and the institutionalization of privileges for some sections of society. No bankers, no financiers and no speculators anymore, on top of all those controlling the means of production, to exploit the work of others for their own benefit. All this, without having to rely on a mythical post-scarcity state of abundance as social ecologists communalists 66 assume, or having to sacrifice freedom of choice and self-management within a vast bureaucratic planning model like Paracon 67 inches fact, the proposed system aims at satisfying the double aim of meeting the basic needs of all citizens, which requires that basic macroeconomic decisions have to be made democratically, and be securing freedom of choice, which requires the individual to make important decisions affecting his or her own life, what work to do, what to consume, etc. Third, covering the basic needs of all people is secured institutionally, so that hunger, homelessness, lack of adequate health care and illiteracy will be things of the barbaric past. Thus, a crucial difference from market-based or planning-based models is ID's crucial distinction between basic and non-basic needs. Remuneration is according to need, as far as basic needs is concerned, and according to effort for non-basic needs. Thus, unlike Paracon, in which basic needs are satisfied only to the extent they are characterized as public goods, or are covered by compassion and by a guaranteed basic income for the unemployed and those who cannot work, 68ID is based on the principle that meeting basic needs is a fundamental human right which is guaranteed to all who are in a physical condition to offer a minimal amount of work. As far as covering basic needs is concerned, ID implements the basic communist principle from each according to his or her ability to each according to his or her need. Fourth, unemployment and job insecurity will also be remembered as part of the barbaric Middle Ages that preceded economic democracy. Today, local economies depend on outside centers for the organization of production and work, for covering their needs in goods and services, even for the provision of social services, education, health, etc. For example, to attract investors, very expensive incentives are used, which usually overlook the ecological implications, while the investments themselves do not maximize local employment, and, instead, create a significant outflow of local income. The World Trade Organization, for instance, made self-reliance in agriculture almost impossible, destroying in the process the livelihood of millions of farmers all over the world and transforming agriculture into an even more chemical-intensive process controlled by big agro business. On the other hand, the local self-reliance implied by the decentralization of an economic democracy would mean maximal utilization of local resources and sources of energy, a process that leads to a corresponding maximization of local employment and, through the multiplier effects, of local income. Work in an economic democracy would be allocated on the basis of the preferences of citizens as producers and as consumers. Thus, citizens, as producers, would select the work they wish to do while citizens, as consumers, through their use of vouchers or credit cards, would determine their own consumption pattern and indirectly the allocation of labor resources in each line of activity. Fifth, an economic democracy, as envisaged by the ID project, implies a high degree of decentralization, physical or at least administrative, so that the main collective political and economic decision unit are the demotic assemblies, that is, the assemblies of all citizens living in a demos of about 30,000-50,000 people, which are then confederated at the city, the regional, or the national level and beyond for decisions which cannot be taken at the local level. This way, the ID project, through its proposed institutional framework, offers the best hope for a better human relationship to nature than could ever be achieved in a market economy, or one based on socialist statism. Thus, political democracy gives the power to the people to decide the relationship of society to nature on the basis of the general interest of the community rather than the special interests of privileged social groups. Furthermore, economic democracy replaces the grow-or-die dynamic of the market economy with a new social dynamic aiming at the satisfaction of demos' needs rather than economic growth. But, if the satisfaction of demotic needs does not depend, as at present, on the continuous expansion of production to cover the needs that the market creates, and if the link between the economy and society is restored, then there is no reason why the present instrumentalist view of nature will continue conditioning human behavior. Particularly so since, unlike socialist models which are centralist, the aim of production in an ID is not growth, but the satisfaction of the basic needs of the community and of those non-basic needs for which members of the community express a desire and are willing to work extra to cover them. Finally, democracy in this social realm would be a decisive step in the creation of the conditions for a harmonious nature-society relationship, as the phasing out of patriarchal relations in the household and of hierarchical relations in general could reasonably be expected to create a new ethos of non-domination that would engulf both nature and society. The peoples of the world have therefore every reason today, before the economic crisis and the parallel ecological crisis destroy the quality of life of most people in the planet, to begin building an ID movement and take steps like the ones described elsewhere, 69, so that we can move to replace the present system of capitalist market economy with an economic democracy as part of an inclusive democracy and transcend the present multidimensional crisis. 1. C.T. Fotopoulos, From Social Democracy to Neoliberalism in Greek Eleftherotypia, 4 and February 5, 1989. 2. C. Cornelius Castoriadis, The Rationality of Capitalism in Figures of the Thinkable, ed. By Werner Hamaker, Stanford, Stanford University Press, 2007. 3. C. Takis Fotopoulos, Towards an Inclusive Democracy, London, N.Y. Castle, 1997/Continuum, 1998, pages 248-50. 4. Kenneth J. Arrow, Problems Mount in Application of Free Market Economic Theory, The Guardian, January 4, 1994. 5. Will Hutton, The State Wherein, London, Jonathan Cape, 1995, pages 237. 6. Carl Polanyi, The Great Transformation, Boston Beacon Press, 1944/1957. 7. Takis Fotopoulos, Towards an Inclusive Democracy, ch. 2. 8. Stephen Foley Galbraith's The Great Crash, 1929 is still essential reading today, The Independent, October 10, 2008. 9. World Development Indicators, World Bank, 2005, Table 1.1. 10. C. Takis Fotopoulos, the ecological crisis as part of the present multidimensional crisis and inclusive democracy, the International Journal of Inclusive Democracy, Volume 3, Number 3, July 2007. 11C Takis Fotopoulos, Class Divisions Today, The Inclusive Democracy Approach, Democracy and Nature, Volume 6, Number 2, July 2000. 12 Margareta Pagano and Simon Evans, 16 Trillion Derivatives Time Bomb, The Independent, December 10, 2008. 13 C.T. Fotopoulos, The Multidimensional Crisis and Inclusive Democracy, The International Journal of Inclusive Democracy, 2005, ch. 1. 14 William K. Tabb, Four Crises of the Contemporary World Capitalist System, Monthly Review, October 2008. 15 Ibid 16 Takis Fotopoulos, Towards an Inclusive Democracy, pages 255-300. 17 Jeffrey A. Miron, Bankruptcy, Not Bailout, Is the Right Answer, CNN Commentary, September 29, 2008. 18 John Gray, A Shattering Moment in America's Fall from Power, The Observer, September 28, 2008. 19 Sean O'Grady, On Monday, The Crisis Seemed to Be Abating, But Now We Know Better, The Independent, October 18, 2008. 20 BBC News, Chinese Economy Growth Rate Slows, October 20, 2008. 21 Terry McAllister, The Crisis Crosses the Pacific, Rio Tinto Warns of Chinese Economy's Pause for Breath, The Guardian, October 16, 2008. 22 Takis Fotopoulos, Transnational Elite and Russia, A New Bipolar World? In this issue. 23 Joseph E. Stiglitz, Good Day for Democracy, The Guardian, January 10, 2008. 24 Emmanuel Wallerstein, 2008 The Demise of Neoliberal Globalization, Yale Global, February 4, 2008. 25 Emmanuel Wallerstein, Le Capitalisme Touché à sa fin, Le Monde 12-13/2008. 26 Takis Fotopoulos, Globalization, The Reformist Left and the Anti-Globalization Movement, Democracy and Nature, Volume 7, Number 2, July 2001. 27 Takis Fotopoulos, Towards an Inclusive Democracy, ch. 1. 28 C. For example, a similar historical account of the rise of Keynesian economics in M. Blaney, The Rise and Fall of Keynesian Economics, London, Macmillan, 1985. 29 C. William K. Tabb, Four Crises of the Contemporary World Capitalist System. 30 Takis Fotopoulos, Iraq, The New Criminal War of the Transnational Elite, Democracy and Nature, Volume 9, Number 2, July 2003. 31 C. Takis Fotopoulos, Transnational Elite and Russia, A New Bipolar World? 32 World Bank, World Development Indicators 2005, Table 1.1. 33 World Bank, From Plant to Market, World Development Report 1996, Table 134, World Development Indicators 2005, Table 1.1. 35 C. On the Manipulation of Statistical Figures to Justify the Case of Elimination of Poverty Today, Takis Fotopoulos, The Elimination of Poverty, The International Journal of Inclusive Democracy, Volume 4, Number 1, January 2008. 36 World Development Indicators 2005, Table 2.5a. 37 Ibid, Table 2.7. 38 Will Hutton, Mao's Children Seek Their Fortune, The Observer, March 20, 2005. 39 Will Hutton, The Writing on the Wall, China and the West in the 21st Century, Little Brown, 2007. 40 Will Hutton, Power, Corruption and Lies, The Guardian, August 1, 2007. 41 Will Hutton, Mao's Children Seek Their Fortune. 42 Takis Fotopoulos, Towards an Inclusive Democracy, ch. 1. 43 ILO, World of Work Report, Income Inequalities in the Age of Financial Globalization, Geneva International Labor Office, 2008. 44 Sam Jones, More Than Half of Jails in England Are Too Full, The Guardian, August 13, 2005. 45 Martin Wallacott, The March of a Martial Law, The Guardian, January 20, 1996. 46 Murray Bookchin, From Urbanization to Cities Castle, 1995, ch. 6 and Cornelius Castoriadis's Castoriadis, Philosophy, Politics, Autonomy, Oxford University Press, 1991, ch. 7. 47c, for example, Thomas S. Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, Chicago University of Chicago Press, 1970. Imre Lakatos, Criticism and the Growth of Knowledge, Cambridge University Press, 1970. Paul Feyerabend, Against Method, London Verso, 1975. 48c. Takis Fotopoulos, The Rise of New Irrationalism and Its Incompatibility with Inclusive Democracy, Democracy and Nature, Volume 4, Nos. 2/3, July-November 1998, pages 1-49. 49c. Takis Fotopoulos, Towards an Inclusive Democracy, CHS 2 and 3. 50t. Fotopoulos, Globalization, The Reformist Left and the Anti-Globalization Movement. 51 for a description of the gradual lifting of capital controls in UK under market pressure. See Will Hutton, The State We're in London, Jonathan Cape, 1995, ch. 3. 52c. Fotopoulos, Towards an Inclusive Democracy, ch. 1. 53c. For example, Pierre Bourdieu, The Essence of Neoliberalism, Utopia of Endless Exploitation, Le Monde Diplomatique, December 1998. 54c. John Sargas and Takis Fotopoulos, The Credit Crisis and the New World Order of Capitalist Anarchy, The International Journal of Inclusive Democracy, Volume 4, No. 1, January 2008. 55. Larry Elliott, Those Who Say This Is Just a Market Wobble Are in Denial, The Guardian, August 17, 2007. 56. Bob Heller, Financiers' Greed Has Put Capitalism at Risk, The Observer, September 9, 2007. 57. Matt Moore, ECB to offer up to $28 billion in dollars, The Associated Press, December 12, 2007. 58. Frederick Lorden, Supremes, Ninja Loans, Derivatives and Other Financial Fantasies, Le Monde Diplomatique, September 2007. 59c. For example, John Dunbar, AP, Uses for $700 billion bailout money ever shifting, AOL Money and Finance, October 25, 2008, 12-22-44. 60. Gordon Brown, Economy Can Emerge Stronger, The Daily Telegraph, October 18, 2008. 61. Peter Mandelson, In Defense of Globalization, The Guardian, March 10, 2008. 62c. For a definition of the transnational elite, T. Fotopoulos, Globalization, The Reformist Left and the Anti-Globalization Movement. 63. Statement by Press Secretary Dana Perino, October 22, 2008. 64. Ann Penketh, Putin Turns on U.S. Irresponsibility, The Independent, February 10, 2008. 65. Takis Fotopoulos, Towards an Inclusive Democracy, ch. 6. 66c. Takis Fotopoulos, The ID Project and Social Ecology, The International Journal of Inclusive Democracy, Volume 1, No. 3, May 2005. 67c. Takis Fotopoulos, Participatory Economics, Paracon and Inclusive Democracy, The International Journal of Inclusive Democracy, Volume 1, No. 2, January 2005. 68. Michael Albert, Paracon Life After Capitalism, London Verso Books, 2003, pages 37-38. 69c. The Transitional Strategy of the Inclusive Democracy Project, The International Journal of Inclusive Democracy, Volume 1, No. 1, October 2004.